morning, and thank you for joining the Hospice New Zealand Palliative Care Lecture Series. Our thanks to Genesis Oncology Trust for their continued sponsorship, which allows us to bring you these lectures. Please be advised that today's call is being recorded on the 6th of October 2016. Our speaker today is Caroline Quilty. Caroline is Therapy Service Manager and Dietitian at St. Joseph's Hospice London. We are delighted she can join us today to present on the role of dietitian in palliative care. Thank you, Caroline. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much. Good morning, everybody. I'm really, really pleased to have this opportunity to speak with you today to talk about the role of dietetics in specialist palliative care and hope that you find the presentation useful in your practice. I have worked in palliative care for the past 3 years, and prior to that I worked in another hospice, so I have quite a long history as a dietitian in palliative care, which I consider to be a very privileged role, and I'm delighted to have the opportunity to talk to you about that today. So if you'd like to turn to slide 2 in your presentation. So as you can see, the aims for this session today are to consider the role of food and nutrition in palliative care. I want to think a little bit about malnutrition and cachexia, to review the place of nutritional screening and assessment. I'll describe around nutritional treatment, and I will also describe the dietetic service here at St. Joseph's Hospice. In order to give some context to where I'm coming from, I just wanted to start by describing the hospice so that you know the kind of environment that I'm currently working in. So if you would turn to slide 3 in your presentation. So St. Joseph's is set in the heart of London's East End. So on the map of the UK, the red dot is roughly where we are. And we are just north and east of the River Thames, as you can see. There's been a hospice on this site for over 100 years, so we have a long history in this area. We serve a very diverse population in East London. It's diverse culturally, socially, and economically. The hospice had a rebuilding program to celebrate the millennium. And the picture that you will see in front of you is our main inpatient unit. Behind that, we have an older part of the building, and we are fortunate enough here in the heart of London to have a really beautiful garden, which is a very therapeutic environment. If you'll turn to slide 4. St. Joseph's is one of the larger hospices in the UK. Our inpatient unit has 42 beds. Between 6 and 8 of those beds are specifically for respite. So that is for patients who come in for a period, a defined period of rehabilitation. They're often patients with non-malignant disease. So we will often see people with lung disease such as COPD, with neurological conditions. But we also do rehab with patients who do have a cancer diagnosis. The rest of the inpatient unit is predominantly for a combination of symptom management. So patients may come in to have symptoms of pain, nausea, constipation, or psychological symptoms supported and managed. Or, of course, patients do come in for end-of-life care. We also have outpatients and day services, and that includes a day hospice where patients come in for one day a week for a period of up to 12 weeks where they can engage in a variety of creative and social activities as well as have the opportunity for rehab and for clinical input. We run lots of different support groups here, and lots of those are run themselves by patients and service users. And we have a range of self-management programs, including for breathlessness and for fatigue management. And we also have a comprehensive community service going out into the area of London that we serve. So patients and their families can access hospice services here in a variety of ways. If you would turn to slide 6. Just to give a view of the range of services that we deliver, obviously nursing and medical services feature very highly, including in our community palliative care team. We're fortunate to have, I think fortunate because I head the service, but we're fortunate to have a very comprehensive therapy service. So that includes physiotherapy, occupational therapy, dietetics, and speech and language therapy. We also offer a range of complementary therapies, such as massage and acupuncture. And that's managed and delivered by a very dedicated volunteer workforce. We have social work and psychosocial therapies, including bereavement support. The day hospice I've already mentioned. And we also have what we call our LiveWell information support service, which is often the first place that people might find out information about the hospice. As well as delivering a service here, we have a very strong outreach program so that people have the opportunity to understand about hospice services actually out in the community. The dietetic service here is very, very well established, and I will describe that a little bit in a little bit more detail further on in the presentation. If you would turn to slide 7. So what I'd really like to do is think a little bit about palliative care that we are working in and how the role of the dietitian and the place of food and nutrition fits into that. And in order to do that, I want to start by thinking about what palliative care is. So you will see the WHO definition of palliative care, which, as it says, is an approach that improves the quality of life of patients and their families facing the problems associated with life-threatening illness through prevention and relief of suffering by means of early identification and impeccable assessment and treatment of pain and other problems, physical, psychosocial, and spiritual. And I do really love that definition because I think it is very holistic and all-encompassing. I feel very passionately that food and nutrition is an essential part of people's treatment on many levels. On the actual physical level of providing nutrients and nutrition, but also on the psychosocial level, which I will talk about in a little bit more detail further in my presentation. Turn to slide number 8. So as you know, palliative care is wide-ranging and may begin many months before someone dies. Here we have an aspiration to reach people as early in their illness as possible so that we can begin thinking about palliative care at an early stage. And as far as nutrition is concerned, I feel that that should be considered as early as possible so that patients and their families can enjoy the maximum benefit from the treatment available. Dietitians, I feel, play a fundamental role in enabling patients to benefit from palliative care by incorporating the nutritional aspects. Now, I feel that we all have a role in nutrition. Food is something that everybody knows about. It's obviously an intrinsic part of everyday life. My work with patients, I'm currently undertaking an MSc research project, and something that's coming quite clearly to me is that the people that I'm speaking to value the opportunity to talk to a specialist in the area. They see the dietitian as somebody who has specialist knowledge that they feel that they may benefit from. And I have seen that in my practice in general. I also feel that nutrition has an important role to play when we're considering rehabilitative palliative care, which is a concept that integrates rehabilitation, enablement, self-management and self-care into a holistic model of palliative care. You turn to slide nine. Slide nine, apologies. This Hospice UK publication was issued last summer, the Rehabilitative Palliative Care, Enabling People to Live Fully Until They Die. And that describes rehabilitative palliative care in quite a lot of detail. It's not within my remit to go into that during this particular presentation, but I would recommend it as an opportunity to have a look at maybe how rehabilitative you are in your approach now. There's a really useful benchmarking tool here that can help to identify where improvements might be made. And there are also some really great examples of good practice within that document, and that can be downloaded from the Hospice UK website. We turn to page 10. So when thinking about nutrition, I think I wanted to start with a definition. So I've chosen a couple here. The word nutrition comes from the Latin word nutrire, meaning feed or nourish. And the Oxford English Dictionary defines it as the process of eating or taking nourishment. Now, I think nourishment can be seen in a variety of ways, as I've already mentioned. So the physical provision of food and also the psychosocial, the emotional and social impact of food, which I will come back to. So concentrating on the physical aspects of nutrition, if you like, we turn to slide 11. So another definition, I'm sorry, lots of definitions here, but malnutrition is something that we see a lot in our patient group. And that there's a definition here, a state of nutrition in which a deficiency or excess of energy, protein and other nutrients causes measurable adverse effects on tissue, body function and clinical outcome. And it's those adverse effects from due to malnutrition that I think we need to be aware of. Turn to slide 12. So malnutrition in itself can refer to undernutrition, so taking in insufficient nutrients, whether that be energy, protein, vitamins or minerals. It will also refer to overnutrition, where we're taking in more nutrients than are needed. Within the context of palliative care, what we see from a dietetic perspective is clearly a majority of undernutrition. The majority of people I see are malnourished due to undernutrition. So that is what I am going to focus on during this presentation. But I think it is important to recognise that overnutrition has its own problems. If you turn to slide 13, there are many consequences of malnutrition on mortality and morbidity, and I've listed some of them here. So consequences such as impaired immune function, delayed wound healing and risk of pressure ulcers, the impact on muscle wasting and the effect that that has, effects on the respiratory muscles, affecting cardiac function, and of course affecting mobility. Malnutrition can have an alter the gastrointestinal structure and function. And also very importantly, I think, can lead to apathy and depression, which can then become a bit of a cycle, because often associated with depression is poor appetite, and poor appetite is also causing apathy and depression. So there's a bit of a cyclical thing going on there. So if we turn to number 14. So in palliative care, we often see patients who are experiencing cachexia. I'm sure that you will all recognise the appearance of the patient shown here. So the word cachexia comes from a Greek root, kakos, meaning bad, and haxis, meaning habit, appearance, or condition. Cachexia has been known for centuries, and it was described very eloquently by Hippocrates, who said the shoulders, clavicles, chest, and thighs melt away. And I'm sure that that's a very familiar picture to you. It certainly is to me. You can see patients who are very, very clearly wasted. The muscle bulk has been lost. If we move to slide 15. So our research shows that approximately 80% of people with advanced cancer have cachexia. And of those, around 50% experience anorexia, which is characterized by poor appetite and reduced food intake. And I'm going to go on to describe cachexia in a moment. But I think that those elements of poor appetite and reduced food intake are very important to acknowledge. I also think it's important to remember that cachexia is not just something that happens in cancer. Cachexia happens in other conditions. And so, for example, in COPD, there's a prevalence of between 20 to 40% of patients with COPD having cachexia, depending on the definition used. But clearly, it is something that's prevalent in other conditions. We turn to slide 16. So there's been a lot of effort put into defining cachexia, and this definition from Fearon et al. From 2011 is the one that I will be talking about. And here cachexia is defined as a multifactorial syndrome characterized by an ongoing loss of skeletal muscle mass. And that's what we're seeing, as given in that example, that picture earlier on, and that's what you will often be seeing in your patients, is that loss of skeletal muscle mass. And that's why patients look so wasted. So the body is starting to use the protein stores for energy rather than just the fat stores for energy. And that is an element of abnormal metabolism. And in cachexia, it can't be fully reversed by nutrition support, and it is a progressive functional impairment. And as I've said, the pathophysiology is characterized by negative protein and energy balance, driven by a variable combination of reduced food intake and abnormal metabolism. So you have a group of people who can't eat as much as they need to, so their energy intake is reduced, and their body's metabolism is working abnormally and using energy more efficiently, if you like, than it should be. So if you turn to slide 17, three distinct phases of cachexia have been described. So starting with pre-cachexia. So at this point, there is weight loss, but it's of around 5% or less. And actually, that isn't a lot of weight loss. So that's around 3 kilos in a 60-kilo individual. And people are also experiencing anorexia at that point, defined as that loss of appetite and diminished intake. Now, what we often find is that patients may not notice that weight loss. They may explain it by all sorts of reasons. They may be undergoing treatment, for example, and they see that a bit of weight loss is a consequence of that treatment. Some people may be overweight to begin with, and certainly people I speak to say they did notice that they were losing weight, but they were quite glad that they were losing weight because they'd always been overweight. So they started losing a few kilos here and there, and they were not particularly bothered by that. I think the difficulty occurs when that starts to become uncontrolled weight loss. If we turn to the next slide, so this is slide 18. So after pre-cachexia, we move into cachexia, and this is represented by a greater weight loss of over 5%. The BMI, body mass index, may be less than 20 kilograms per meter squared. You might be seeing sarcopenia, which is a loss of muscle mass and the weight loss, slightly less weight loss. People are experiencing reduced food intake, and also systemic inflammation is occurring, and that's indicated by, for example, raised CRP. So at this point, the weight loss is becoming more apparent, and this might be the stage that people start to flag up the fact that they're losing weight and start trying to do something about it. And we'll talk a little bit about the treatment shortly. We turn to slide 19. The final stage, if you like, of cachexia is what we call refractory cachexia. And it's at this point, really, that the cachexia can't be reversed. So the disease is procatabolic, it's non-responsive to anti-cancer treatment. So people may still be having, for example, palliative chemotherapy, but it is about palliation rather than a curative treatment. People at this stage will have a relatively low performance score and will probably have a fairly short prognosis. And this stage, I think, is particularly distressing for patients and for their families, because that's when we see the really marked weight loss. And people find it very difficult to overcome the weight loss. If we turn to slide 20. Often what people say to me is that they've noticed the weight loss, they're trying very hard to do something about it, but they're finding that quite difficult, and we'll talk about that a bit further. Here at St. Joseph's, all of our patients undergo nutritional screening. So this is a holistic nutritional screening that we use when patients are admitted onto our inpatient unit or when they are first seen as part of our community service. So at this point, as part of their holistic assessment, we're looking at their weight, their height, their BMI. We're thinking very much about what weight change has occurred. And I think the weight change is important in the context of what I've just described with regards to the cachexia. We're asking questions about change of appetite, perhaps the need for texture modification. Has anything changed with how somebody is able to swallow or chew? We might be looking at whether somebody's on a nutritional supplement or whether they're using artificial nutrition and hydration through tube feeding, for example. We're also considering comorbidities such as diabetes, renal disease, heart disease, and thinking about the psychosocial impact of poor appetite. So this part is very much used to identify patients that might be having some problems around maintaining their weight and around eating and drinking. And here we use that as a trigger for referral. So if somebody scores, if somebody is showing quite a low BMI, or if they have lost weight over the past 3 to 6 months, that will usually be a trigger for a referral to the dietitian. If somebody is exhibiting swallowing difficulties, then we will use that as a trigger for referral to the speech and language therapist. We also consider the role that our catering service can provide to inpatients, because for some patients, it may not be that they need specialist clinical input, but they certainly need to have a discussion with somebody about what they're going to manage to eat and drink while they are an inpatient, for example. I think the nutritional screening is also really important, particularly when we're thinking about increasing obesity within our patients, because we do see patients who are obese, but who have lost a lot of weight prior to coming in unintentionally. And actually, I feel confident that the screening is working when somebody who weighs about 100 kilos is referred to me because they are having difficulty, because it's you know, we do actually find out that that person has lost 20 kilos in the past 3 months unintentionally. So those people can sometimes be more difficult to spot. Obviously, somebody coming in at 30, 40 kilos, it's easier to see that, you know, they obviously are having difficulties. So there's something positive about picking up people who may be overweight, still overweight, for example, but who have lost weight and are having problems. If we move to slide number 21, the Malnutrition Universal Screening Tool is a tool that's commonly used in the UK and in other countries. It's a validated tool. And a lot of our local areas will use the Malnutrition Universal Screening Tool, MUST, in order to identify people who need dietetic intervention, for example. So sometimes I will use this tool if I'm referring a patient on into my colleagues in the community. We also have to consider how appropriate it is to weigh patients. Here it's fairly routine. Clearly we don't weigh people who are admitted for end-of-life care because that would not be appropriate. But people who are coming in for a symptom management admission will generally be weighed unless on admission they are too unwell or if it's felt inappropriate to weigh them. However, even if you're not weighing somebody, I think we use our clinical judgment and use a subjective global assessment by looking at the patient and observing if there's any weight loss. So I'm sure if we were doing this interactively, I'm sure that you would tell me lots of signs, but the things that I would be looking for are things like the fit of clothes, the fit of rings, wedding rings, for example, that are dropping off fingers, wristwatches that are pushed right up the arm because of, you know, the fact somebody's lost a lot of weight. Often you see belts pulled 3 or 4 or 5 holes tighter. Dentures being very loose. These are all signs that an individual has lost a substantial amount of weight and will often be the first trigger that them, you know, that there are difficulties happening. We turn to the next slide, 22. So having identified weight loss and identified maybe distress around weight loss, we need to think about nutritional treatments. I'm a very firm believer in food first as a form of nutritional treatment. I think sometimes it can be easy to default to the use of supplements, which we will talk about in a minute, but food is important on very many levels. And one of the things it provides is that sometimes enjoyment for patients and a feeling of normality. So food is where I will normally start. We also do consider the use of oral nutritional supplements. I'll talk a little bit about enteral and parenteral feeding. I'll think a little bit about supportive management of comorbidity. So how do we manage the nutritional impacts in renal disease, in diabetes, for example, and think about families and carers. So if we move to the next slide, 23. So as I said, from a nutritional treatment point of view, food first is always my motto, if you like. So the first thing I will do is work through with the patient and their family, if it's appropriate, how they are managing to eat, what kinds of foods they're managing to eat, and think about simple ways to make that food as nourishing as possible. So for example, we might change from a low-fat milk to a full-fat milk so that somebody can get the maximum amount of energy from that particular, from that drink. We might add extra butter or margarine onto toast and onto crackers, adding in into foods like mashed potato, anything that it feels that can go into. We might add cream or milk, so double cream into porridge or a swirl of milk into a bowl of soup. So it's about thinking of ways to make the food that the patient is eating as high in energy as possible, as nutritious as possible, but without them having to eat a lot more, because as I'm sure you'll recognize, patients really, really struggle with portion sizes. So it's no good saying to somebody, just eat more. That just isn't going to work. So we're looking at trying to make the small amounts of food as nourishing as possible. We'll often think about a small and often meal plan. So, for example, at lunchtime, if the normal thing is to have a bowl of soup and some bread and then follow that with a small dessert, we'll often think about spreading that throughout the afternoon. So maybe have the dessert, have a little bit of the bread, an hour or so later, have another little bit of that to eat, an hour or two later, have the dessert. And again, at the other meal times, just so that, again, you're getting the same amount of food in, but it's spread out, and that makes it a little bit easier for people to take it. We might also think about texture modification. Sometimes people do find chewing quite difficult. I mean, obviously, if they've got a dysphagia, if they really are not able to swallow effectively, then that's when I get my speech and language therapy colleague involved. But sometimes people do find softer foods are easier. If they're nauseous, they might find cold foods are much easier to take. We might think about citrus and ginger type flavors. So it's very much working with the individual to find out, you know, to find some nutritional solutions for them. If we turn to the next slide, number 24. Having mentioned nutritional supplements, they can be really, really useful. They're really great sources of energy, protein, vitamins and minerals. And I've given some examples there of the kind of products we use here. I'm sure that you have very similar. I often find that people have been through every supplement under the sun and often are really fatigued with the supplements. They know that they can be useful, but they've had them, they've had every flavor, they've had every version, and they're not really doing it for them anymore. But we do often try different supplements and presenting them in different ways to see if that can be a useful source of nutrients for an individual. But we often find poor compliance related to taste fatigue. So people have, you know, they're just bored of the taste. And people also can experience GI symptoms. So early satiety, feeling full really, really quickly, might cause abdo-distension, might provoke nausea and diarrhea. So I think when we are using the nutritional supplements, we need to do it with some level of caution and on a very, very individual basis. If somebody finds something that they really enjoy, then I will always ensure that, you know, they have access to that. But I often find that people just are very, very fatigued with having supplements. So I try not to use it as a default position. If we turn to the next slide, number 25. Another element of nutritional treatment that we see very commonly is enteral feeding. So that may be nasogastric tube feeding, it may be gastrostomy feeding or jejunostomy feeding. And I have to say, having worked in palliative care 10 years ago, at that point you would rarely see somebody on tube feeding. Coming back into palliative care 3 years ago, the one thing that struck me was the number of patients who are admitted with a tube already in situ, and usually a gastrostomy type tube, which I think indicates that enteral feeding is being started much earlier in people's disease. And you'll see that particularly in head and neck cancers, for example, in cancer of the esophagus, and also we often see that in patients with neurological conditions where there is a deteriorating swallow. So enteral feeding can be a very important part of the work that we do. I work very closely with patients and their families when someone's admitted with enteral feeding, because I think it's really important to understand what their priorities are and to think about how we manage that enteral feeding, particularly during a deteriorating illness. So particularly, say, if somebody is approaching end-of-life care. So that will often be a whole team discussion, and that team involves the patient, if they're able to, and their family, as well as the wider multidisciplinary team. I will often be guided by how the patient is feeling. So if a patient is I often find people come to me on regimes that are designed for people who are relatively fit and well and fairly active. And the patient can often feel as if they're having too much volume, they feel sick, they feel nauseous. So we will adjust the feeding regime so that the patient is comfortable. So we might reduce how much they're having, or we might change the timing of when they're having their nutrition. But that can be a very, very careful balance, because people often are very concerned if we're starting to reduce how much feeding somebody is having, because that can often be an indicator of their deteriorating function. And if we turn to the next slide, so this is number 26, I've just mentioned parenteral nutrition. Now, it's very interesting. In the UK, we don't see a lot of parenteral nutrition taking place in the palliative care setting. So we accept patients if they're on parenteral nutrition here at the hospice. It happens very infrequently. In places like the US and in parts of Europe, it's much more common that parenteral nutrition takes place for people during the palliative course of their illness. And it's often used for people who've got a prognosis of 2 to 3 months, say, in malignant bowel obstruction. So the gut isn't working, and it's that balance about the patient starving versus when the disease will take its effect. So increasingly, parenteral nutrition is considered, but as I say, less so in this country. So my experience is relatively limited. I do feel that over the next few years, that will probably change, just as coming back to palliative care a few years ago, I saw how enteral feeding had changed. I feel that similar things will be happening within parenteral nutrition. And certainly if we look across the world, that does seem to be happening. Parenteral nutrition can be have quite a burden on the patient and on their family, but it's also balancing that up against the quality of life that good level of nutrition will also bring somebody. So those two things need to be balanced out, and that's very much in collaboration with the patient to work out what is most important for them. If we turn to the next slide, number 27, within the nutritional treatment, we also need to think about comorbidities like renal disease and diabetes. So thinking about diabetes, for example, people will often come to me who've been on a diet for their diabetes for the majority of their life. For 50 years, they've had to think about what they eat and drink in relation to their diabetes. And we get to the point where people may only be able to eat very small amounts of food, and the thing that they really want is a little bit of pudding or some ice cream or something sweet. And people often say, oh, I don't think I should have that because of my diabetes. So we have to have very careful discussions about what the priorities are. And if we're thinking about managing somebody's blood glucose levels, we're often... In a healthy person with diabetes, we're thinking about minimizing the long-term complications. For somebody in the palliative course of their illness, we may actually be thinking, actually, what's most important here might just be avoiding symptoms of hyperglycemia, for example. Those symptoms can be very unpleasant, thirsty, feeling tired, lethargic. So we might just need to do a little bit of management with that. And my aim, I often speak with my medical colleagues, and we actually think about, let's look at the treatment, the insulin treatment or the oral hypoglycemics, and see, can we do something with those to keep the blood sugar levels under control while enabling that patient to eat whatever they want, because that feels like the most important thing at that time. So that's a very careful discussion within an MDT and with the patient, and working out what the patient's priorities are. And some patients, their priority is eating healthily, and they want to continue to do that for as long as they can. And where that's the case, then I will support them as much as I can to do that. If we turn to the next slide, number 28. I just wanted to talk a little bit about the psychosocial impact of poor appetite, because this is something that I feel very strongly about and I see very, very frequently within my practice. We know that weight loss is not only a physical impact, but it also includes the psychosocial consequence, and that may impact on somebody's compromise somebody's quality of life. The emotional meaning attributed to food changes through the stages of our lives. And for individuals in the palliative stage of their illness, food can take on both positive and negative meaning. So positive things can be around hope, comfort, a reminder of happier times. Negative feelings might include guilt about not eating, dread of meal times, and in some cases refusing food to hasten death, because people know that they need to eat to survive. If you turn to the next slide, 29. So at the early part of my talk, I used that word nourish, and I think nourish has many meanings. I think nutrition isn't just about the nutritional value of food. It's about how we care for each other, care for ourselves. It's about nurturing. It's a way of showing love. It's a way that we socialize. It's a way that we share good times and bad times. And it's about something about normality in our life. So if you think most of our religious festivals will be related to around food in some way, that may be fasting or it may be special meals to celebrate a particular festival or time of the year. If we're celebrating with somebody, we meet them and go out for a meal. We bake birthday cakes to celebrate our birthdays. So much of our social life and our emotional life, I think, is focused around food. So there are powerful emotions around eating and drinking. If we turn to the next slide, what people say to me is this kind of thing. This is what carers say. I feel frustrated. I spend all morning cooking a delicious lunch. He eats two spoonfuls and pushes it away. They ask, what will happen if she doesn't eat? They know the answer to that question, but it worries them. Patients say to me, all people say is, I have to eat, I must eat. They never leave me alone. They're nagging at me. So it can become a real area of conflict between patients and those close to them. If we move to the next slide, number 31, so what support can we give as healthcare professionals? Well, I think it's really important that if we are weighing patients or if we are observing weight loss, that we respond to that weight change, avoiding the weight loss taboo. So this is when we see weight loss is happening. We know why it's happening. Probably somebody's in the advanced stage of their illness. They are cachectic. We feel that there might be not much that we can do to actually change that. So what people often say to me is, nobody ever talks to me about my weight loss. They weigh me, they write it down, and then they don't say anything about it. And people find that really quite difficult and quite frustrating. And patients often know that there isn't much that can be done, but what they do say to me really clearly is, I just need somebody to talk to me about it. I just need somebody to listen to my concerns or to acknowledge that this is happening and not just treat it like a clinical thing, like measuring your blood pressure or the SATs or whatever, but actually acknowledge that that weight loss means something to that patient. I think we need to give patients and families the opportunity to talk about their weight and poor appetite and actually acknowledge that that weight loss may be due to cachexia, and that so that sometimes that takes away that kind of guilt and worry. People say, oh, I'm trying to do this, I'm trying to do that, and no matter what I try, it doesn't make any difference. And sometimes when I explain to people, actually it's because of what's happening with your cancer, it's the way that your body is functioning because of the cancer. Sometimes people find that useful. They don't always find that useful, because that can be quite a hard thing to hear. But I do think we need to acknowledge it and recognize it and give people the opportunity to talk about it. And I think we can all give advice. We can all give useful suggestions for people to try. I think referral to a specialist, if it's available, I think is useful because it gives people the opportunity to talk about their particular condition. So if we just turn quickly, I'm going to just go over the next few slides quite quickly because I'm conscious of the time. I suppose, from a service point of view here at St. Joseph's, we were very fortunate about 3 years ago that the service was recognised as needing an increased level of input. So we went from having 1.5 days a week of a dietitian to 3 days a week of a specialist dietitian. So that has given the opportunity to do quite a lot of new and different work here, which I think is very positive. I would think that because I am the dietitian, but I think it gives us the opportunity to be very proactive with patients and their families. So I can be involved with inpatients, I can see some outpatients, and I can also support some of our symptom management groups, such as our breathlessness group and our fatigue group. Go to the next slide, number 33. You'll see that I see patients with both a cancer and a non-cancer diagnosis. That does reflect the population that we have here within the hospice. But I just think it's interesting just to note that it isn't all just cancer, that other disease is quite increasing. On page 34, you'll see that the vast majority of my contacts are in the inpatient unit. That is because of how the service is designed. So I think we're fortunate to have a service here in the hospice. If patients need ongoing support at home, then I will refer them to my community colleagues. And on the next slide, 35, you'll see that the majority of the contact, the type of intervention is for nutrition support, and that is anything from food first that I described earlier through to the use of supplements. There's a significant number of people who have got artificial nutrition and support, so tube feeding. And also quite a substantial part of my workload is defined here as communication with patients, but that is those opportunities to talk with patients and their families. You might not be giving any specific nutritional dietetic intervention, but actually it's that psychosocial, that supportive discussion around what is happening with somebody at that time, and enabling people to have the opportunity to talk about their concerns. And sometimes it might be the first time that, say, partners have spoken to each other about their concerns around food and drink. So I can sometimes play a little bit of liaison role within that. We turn to the next slide. The other things that I'm also able to do is I chair the hospice nutrition group. So that's a multidisciplinary group, and we talk about everything from the hospice menu right through to what type, you know, whether we should be doing parenteral feeding. So very, very broad-based multidisciplinary group. I work very closely with the catering providers, and I do a lot of training and education for staff because I'm not with the patients 24/7. Our nursing teams and our healthcare assistants are really, really important in supporting patients around their eating and drinking. I've been able to develop a nutrition policy and their various procedures and guidelines, and also I set up and chair a network group of hospice dietitians and speech and language therapists, mainly because around London there are people who are working fairly single-handed. So they might be single-handed in post. They might work one day a week in a hospice as a dietitian or a speech and language therapist. So in the acknowledgement of that, we've set up this network group, and we meet 3 or 4 times a year as a networking to share experiences and also for some clinical support and supervision. So if you turn to the last slide, number 7, so food as treatment. So you see, again, I think what I'm really wanting to bring across is how important it is about thinking about food. It's not about nutrients. It's not about energy, protein, vitamins. It's about food in its entirety. And That's a nice picture of afternoon tea. It's the wrong time of the day for both you in the morning and me in the evening, but just to give an example there. So if you turn to the next two slides, I've listed some references there in case you know that you're interested. And really at that point, I'd like to thank you very much for being there, I hope. And I can now hand over to the operator if there are any questions.